So today, I just came from a teachers meeting, the American Zen Teachers Association, out of Great Vow, and it was a like 4 days, and it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of laid back programming because the main point of it is all for these Zen teachers, all leading centers, to just be able to get together and form connections and friendships and share ideas and commiserate and all of this stuff. So I didn't have time to like really write a nice long formal talk, but I th thought I would share with you a question that one of my podcast listeners, I think she's from Chile. Yes. And she was, earnestly wrote me this question, and didn't know whether I would have time to address it or at all. But I just thought this was a really poignant question that I think many of you, I certainly resonate with. And then we would address it. But essentially, this talk could be called, "Is Buddhism Compatible with 21st Century Life?" So she says, "I have been studying the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths, and I'm becoming increasingly frustrated at the fact that this path seems to be literally incompatible with our modern times. Unless maybe you renounce everything and go live as a monk, which I literally couldn't even do if I wanted to, because I can't afford a plane ticket, and I'm a woman, and so doing anything alone is really dangerous. I live in Chile. I also have a chronic disease, so there's no way I could live without modern medicine. There's no getting a job without a little lying, and being nice and pure does not always lead to success. What I mean is that life has taught me that being a good person and doing the right thing can often do me more harm than good. Being selfless makes people take advantage of you and use you as a scapegoat. Literally everything we do harms others. The clothes I'm wearing were made by exploiting others, but it's all I can afford. The water we drink was obtained unethically and is harming the environment. The car I need to drive, well, I don't even think that needs an explanation as to why it's harmful. It just makes no sense. It is impossible to live nowadays without harming others, the environment, animals, etc. It's impossible to get a job and have money to pay for my meds and basic needs without being connected to social media, the news, lying, manipulating, faking smiles. Sometimes people make up lies about you and you have to defend yourself, and that feels awful. I wish I could just live ignoring this and focusing on myself, but it's virtually impossible, and inaction can have negative consequences. Anxiety and depression plagues our society, and we live constantly comparing each other's lives. I really wish I could follow the path, but it seems just unrealistic. What can I do? How can I rid myself from dukkha if I can't even get to work without feeling guilty for harming the environment with my car or even for drinking bottled water? I don't know what to do." So, how, I guess, I don't know if anybody wants to just speak about your responses to this, not as an answer. I don't think that's where we want to go yet. Like, here's how I've figured it out. But at to what extent do you feel or wrestle with these kinds of questions? Because I think even if we have found a way that we find sustainable to deal with it, think about it, cope, whatever, it's not a permanent situation, right? So I guess just invite if anybody has anything they want to add or share to this modern koan, which I think all of you have heard me speak about this, I think, but I don't know if anybody's familiar with the show The Good Place. And I mean, I don't want to give it away if you haven't seen the show, but essentially at some point they realize that just like this point system, you get into heaven if you, you know, have a pretty, pretty clean, good record. And like, essentially nobody's getting into heaven anymore, because anything you do, you just go buy some flowers for your mom for Mother's Day, and now like these flowers were you know, grown with terrible herbicides, and there's people in the fields and they're getting sprayed with the herb, you know. It's like any good you do kind of has these attached demerits, so nobody's getting to heaven anymore. Anyway, that's what makes me think of it. But Leah,
I just want to support the question by saying, yes, what a great question. And I think of it constantly, especially as a person with medical needs. It's fraught, let's put it that way, to think about what it would be like if I didn't live in modernity, right? In this sort of civilization world where we have research and doctors and medicine and plastic and chemicals and all that. I mean, it is a koan indeed to think about, you know, what I need. And then I feel very selfish. It's like, well, I need these things. It's like, yeah, but I'm supposed to be very Zen Buddhist about it at the same time. So yes, to support that, definitely.
Paulette?
Yeah, it's the same. I totally get where this person's coming from. like for me, I've been sort of on this, I don't know, this trying to make an effort to not harm animals in any way. And it feels like it's impossible. Because even cosmetics, you know, if they sell them in China, then they're automatically tested on animals. But even if they don't do that, I mean, that's pretty much a just cancel it out if they sell products in China. But, you know, there's ingredients along the way that could harm animals in the way that they're acquired and, you know, even indirectly through, you know, how they're transported. And so it is, it's kind of can be very defeating, because you feel like, how can I actually be true to this non-harming principle? Yeah. So I appreciate this question.
Rachel and then Yoli.
I also want to voice my support for this question, because it's a rough question. And for me, I think about this question when I do like any sort of shopping, because you want to support, you know, the local people for their jobs and things like that. But then the companies are also exploiting these things. And then you're trying to figure out, well, what's the ethics here? And it almost feels like you're digging into a hole that never ends. And it's not just the stores, it's also like grocery shopping is the same thing. You want to support local, you want to do these things, but then there's exploitations of, well, agricultural laws aren't very great and farmers can get hurt and they're not having the greatest time with droughts and stuff and not getting support and they're getting exploited. And it continues on and on and on. And it feels defeating. And I agree with everyone that says that it really feels like, how do you not harm someone when all you're doing is harm? You know what I mean?
Yoli and then Steve.
Yeah, this is a great question and something I ruminate about all the time. I was listening. So I bought an electric vehicle a couple of years ago. I wanted an SUV and I would only buy it if it was electric. But the components that this electric vehicle needs, it's oftentimes obtained through exploitation of our resources. And I was listening to a program on NPR about Panama and their copper mining, their copper mines, and how it's hurting the environment, yet we need this stuff for, you know, the stuff that's going to help us environmentally later. And that's a big conundrum. And the same thing with clothing. I was also reading something about how easy it is to buy clothes online. I hate trying stuff on. And people have the tendency to buy a number of different sizes when they order clothing. And it turns out that these clothes are not reshelved. They're incinerated or thrown into a landfill. Unfortunately, I don't do that because I don't like to spend all that money up front. But even things like that, where we think that we're, you know, the convenience, there's a price to pay for the convenience. And also with online companies like Temu and Shein, who they produce a lot of stuff, but it's considered throwaway clothing. And all of this stuff ends up in our landfills. And so, yeah, it's a lot of things to think about. And I just want to be mindful whenever I buy something, because I can't change anything. But if I can do my own part, I guess I have to live with that. So
Steve, and then I will move on. we'll open it up again after. Steve, go ahead. You're still muted.
There is a song lyric from, I think it's from the 1960s. I'm not sure who is it, but the song lyric goes, there are nicer ways to do things, but the nicer ways always fail. And I often feel confronted with these situations that life is telling you, okay, you want to get from point A to point B. These are your choice of weapons to get to point B, because there's no other way to get there. Yes, you can take the nicer way, but you're going to get left behind. You're going to get pushed aside. Someone's going to take advantage of you being too nice, and you're not going to get to point B. So this is what you have to do. And I hate it that I always have to think, which is the less devious way that I can get to my goal? Because there doesn't seem to be any nice ways to get to where I want to be sometimes, other than, you know, even if you have to be just slightly rude, or perhaps you have to tell just a small little lie to get there. But I've always looked at the road and said, this is the only way to get there. And it just sucks that I have to do it that way. Or, like I said, I get left behind, and you don't want to get left behind. You know, that's it.
I think it is a perfectly appropriate outcome of our practice that we end up really wanting to live a pure and ethical life. Not just in the sense that I think most of us, you know, even before we came to practice, wanted to be a good person. You know, that kind of set of moral guidelines we aspired to. But with practice, as we explore more deeply, we really start to see how we are interdependent with all beings, how to lie to badmouth others, to kind of cheat or steal in any way, starts to hurt. Like, we really, it's not even just a matter of there's a rule out there, or we can get away with it. We don't want to do this anymore. We don't want to do this harm. We see this so vividly. And then we have our precepts and we have our bodhisattva vows. beings are numberless. I vow to free them all. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them all. So like there's this, the practice is pointing us toward this longing to live this life of no harming and purity. And then we have, as Sophie mentioned in her question, this kind of monastic ideal, right? Too, that the Buddha and then subsequently, if you really want to do this practice, you just, you know, if you forgo the marketplace and you don't have a family, so you don't have to look after the family, so you don't have to, you know, absorb yourself and all of these things that if we have to participate in society, right, then we got to do this and then we got to do that. And then we have to pay taxes, and then the taxes are going towards things that we don't agree with. And then it's all gets very complicated. So the monastic ideal of just like stepping out of the whole world to be able to live this life of non-harming, and the, you know, even the original Buddhist monastics, they don't, you know, there's like 250 rules. They don't dig in the ground. They cannot farm or garden because they might kill something. And to some extent, when I think about that, and I think about being able to live a life where I know I am not harming a single thing, just sounds so lovely. And I lived for a while like that, right? I had a junior monkhood where I would live very, very simply, live in community. I didn't have much of my own. It's very efficient to live in community, to share resources, so you don't all have to have your own this and your own that, and to cook together and eat together and all that. But then I had my fill of that, you know, and I wanted to get married, and I wanted to have my own space, and then I get a house, and then I get a, you know, and then it all just gets more complicated from there. So I think there is this longing toward that purity. And it seems like Buddhism is pointing us toward that. And it's so, it is such a struggle in our, and maybe it always has been to some degree or another, but I do think that things have just gotten more complicated at a, you know, I don't know what you call it, exponential scale. Because all the karmic connections have just gotten so so intricate, you know, this is the global culture where we're tied to everything. So what can we do with that that longing, that aspiration, and yet day by day we don't seem to have the option to fulfill that. We have to live day by day kind of making these compromises, and sometimes they're compromises which we, you know, it's clear we have to do, but then there's a lot of compromises where we're like, well, I mean, we don't have to, you know, we don't have to go on that vacation. If I look through my closet, even the simple way I dress, I'm going to find some fast fashion in there, right? I mean, my husband cooks for me. He throws an Italian sausage in with the you know, pasta. I'm not going to say, no, I'm not going to eat that. Make me something else. I eat it. I don't even really want to think about where all that comes from. You know, I think of it as like a permanent sense of moral stress. So when we think about what the Dharma is pointing us toward, where, you know, how can we live with this? How can we practice with this? Because it seems like a continuous state of agitation and dissatisfactoriness. And I guess what I'm experimenting with now, and I'm throwing this out for you all. So I do not claim that this is like, I have this solution, so I'm never troubled anymore. That's not the nature of it. But just as in Zazen, when whatever is arising in our Zazen, our thoughts, our feelings, our boredom, our dullness, whatever, and if we can expand our awareness to include that, that is what is happening right now. There is a way we change our relationship to it. We don't have to like it or dislike it. It's just right. Like it. So there is a way that we can give up our resistance to the state of things. And give up our resistance to the fact that we are going to live in moral stress every day for the rest of our lives. And we're not going to reach the end of that. Which to me is kind of like, oh, it's kind of a difficult thing to contemplate. And yet, I don't know about you, but there's a certain kind of there's a certain level of ease inside about that. When I give up this sense that I should be able to end it, I should be able to escape this sense of moral stress and ambiguity, as opposed to, I don't know, like you got a health condition, you got chronic pain. I'm gonna just be here. I'm gonna feel this. Sometimes it's gonna suck, and sometimes I'm gonna be able to kind of rise above it. And we can accept that that is going to be the case. And it's like we never, but that doesn't mean we give up the effort, right? We don't give up the effort to try to minimize harm. But maybe it's kind of like we find a middle way with it. Maybe at one extreme is just we're going to try to not do any harm at all and feel guilty and awful when we can achieve that. And then, but the other side is there's no way that we can avoid doing harm. So, you know, and I at this teacher's conference, there was one of the teachers, I arranged for people to give short talks. So you can sign up to give a 10 to 15 minute talk. And it could be anything Dharma related. So these different teachers signed up and did very different things. But the teacher, a Rinzai teacher, Genjo Marinello from Seattle, gave a talk and was very sweet. I mean, he's an elder teacher and was really neat. But he said that at his center and the way that he thinks about it, he's kind of translated the Bodhisattva vows. So when we say, you know, I vow to beings are numberless, I vow to free them, delusions are inexhaustible. So I can't remember exactly how he, you know, does the whole phrase, but essentially he sums it up as we vow to care. We vow to care. I really love that. It's such an open-ended thing, you know, so there's no point at which we're going to go, oh, well, you know, I'll just go ahead and do this action, even though I suspect it does harm, and not worry about it at all because it's all just too complicated. But to care, which, you know, in a world of, this is like, so Hogan is one of the teachers out at Great Vow, and I've been in his orbit for 30 years or so, and he he's always the spokesperson for the absolute, right? He is just, and he admits it, he only has one message. It's just like, so when people are talking about this kind of thing and they're like, oh, he's like, be like, from the beginning, There has been some sorrow. There is no escape from samsara, and it will never end. Like, it's just like, duh. But to an extent, it is true. We know that the world could be better. We know that there could be less harm, and we could live more in harmony with the earth, and all of that. We know it. We've seen improvements over the history of humanity. So we know it. And yet, even if all of that was to be able to come to pass, you know, it's a complete delusion that then we would have a complete utopia, no suffering, no loneliness, no injustice. I think it's natural to kind of long for that state, but it's we're never going to arrive there. So I will, those are some of my thoughts. Other questions and comments? Eric.
Hi. This was a perfect bookend for me to the last lesson you did before you left, where you talked about there's no solace. Mm. And I think, I don't know if you planned it that way, but it's very good, because I've been meditating. I'm sorry, I've got to hit my earphone out. I'm hearing it twice and it's throwing me off. I've been meditating about that since that lesson, because I am more on the spiritual side, and I can't help but be, I don't know if an optimist is the right word, but I believe in the tenets and in breaking free from suffering. And I think that there is more that we don't know about what we're doing consciously. And so for me, I feel like this is just the perfect resolve to that question and to that, that last lesson of there's no solace, because I think we are called to be the solace. I think that's what our Buddha nature is. I think it's why we take Bodhisattva vows, is not so much that we can fix everything that's wrong, but if we can find that middle way between annihilation and complete subservience or asceticism, I think that is the right answer, because what it does is it allows us, if not to break free, at least to navigate through samsara and allow Absolutely. Us, the bodhisattva or the Buddha nature, in our lives. And I think that, as you said, caring is the way that we get through it. And I remember there was a quote, I don't know where it comes from, but it was, the greatest thing that you can ever do is to spend time meditating and working towards reaching enlightenment. And I think that if we focus on that and then try to make our life as good as possible, to care as much as possible, I think that's what actually will wind up changing the world, rather than going in and trying to attach to these things that are negative and causing them sorrow and trying to change them, which is also a form of aversion. So that's my take. Thank you for the lesson.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, as a teacher, as somebody who feels, you know, responsible for the well-being of a community, and not everybody is, you know, looking to me for answers, but sometimes people are like, you know, what can help? And I mean, I definitely have a mind that wants to fix things and wants to solve problems. But there is another way in which perhaps the greatest gift I can give you all, and you can give the people in your orbit, is a kind of groundedness and strength despite all of it. And that's the reason that, and it's just a little aside here, I could have done this on the announcements, I guess, but it's a little ways away, but on election night, we meet on Tuesdays. So on November 5th, instead of having a class, we will just sit and ask anybody who's participating in Dirt Zendo or the cloud to just go on a news blackout for the duration. And then we will check the news at the end of the night together. and whatever happens, like, you know, there is a way to remain strong, whatever happens. James, and then Jimmy.
Thank you. I was very pleased to hear you invoke Genjo Maranello's statement there, because when I practiced Rinzai in his lineage, I sat Dokusan with him. I was there to present a koan to him in the Dokusan room, and it was like, bring me the sound of the temple bell or something. I can't even remember exactly which koan it was, and I don't know what I did. I probably did something too fluffy. And he said, if I asked you to throw me a baseball, and I said I was going to catch the baseball, what would you do? And I just made this motion of throwing the baseball, and he made a motion of catching it with a catcher's mitt. And he said, that's it. You know, you just do what you can do, right? You just do the next thing that needs doing. It doesn't have to be some grandiose universal truth that you're solving the problems of the entire world. It just has to be, what can you do right now, right here? You know, and that was such a profound teaching for me. And so then I probably presented, and was, you know, fine, and he rang me out and all the thing, but it was just such a relief. Like, I think you used a word similar to that, if not that exact word, that it's a relief to think, if I just do the next thing that I can do with the power that I have to make a difference, that's the best I can do within that, you know, surrendering to this spiritual malaise that we're always going to be in. Like, it's all, that's going to be the truth of it, that I can just do the next thing that needs doing. So I appreciate that very much. You got me thinking about that topic again. So thank you.
Well, and then, but then there's this, this weird, I don't know. I mean, I still have an idea when you say, like, the next thing in front of me. And I just think, like, okay, so next time I go to Fred Meyer and I'm picking someone up from the shelf, like, then it's still easy for that ideal to arise, that then I will just stay, like, super mindful and be able to navigate and avoid, you know, causing harm when all of my choices, when I know, you know, part of it is going to be picking this up and just being like, I don't have time to research this shit. I got to get things done. Like, right. Like, it's like a constant kind of compromise. But then I guess that's just, you know, not taking ourselves so seriously. And also, you know, there's that, any time there is this sense of I that we are adding to the whole scenario, we add dukkha, right? I am concerned about my moral state and the impact of my, like, I'm telling a big story, like I'm writing a novel about it, and I'm, or, you know, like, I'm worried about my points and whether I'm going to get into heaven, as opposed to it just being like, this is just what's happening. Jinryu.
I think I'm just piggybacking maybe on what others have said, but I do appreciate the question very much, and it is so rich in teaching, I think. But if it weren't for the kinds of things that is being brought up in the question, I don't mean the harm that's being done, but I mean the questions that are in that question, I don't know what else I would practice on. So to me, the question sums up what I am trying to do in my practice. And I don't know if it's the skandhas or karma or both. I don't know, but it's this spinning around and around and around until you just go down the hole and you're exhausted by it all. And I don't think that is the way my practice is supposed to be. I think if I stay in the moment, I do less of that. And as these things come up, that's just another mindfulness reminder, if you will, during the day, at least for me, of I'm doing what I can do. I'm staying in the moment. I'm doing the best that I can. Am I doing the best that I can with this? And to a major extent, that's what my practice consists of. Thanks.
That kind of that question, am I doing the best that I can do? And I certainly, I will tend to do this now, and I'm certainly in the past. Like, when I think about that, I think about it like looking back at, standing back and looking at my life, like overall, am I doing the best that I, like an evaluation from here, as opposed to just in the, in this very moment, which, I mean, there's a time to probably look back and evaluate your life and see if maybe you can make some changes and stuff. But in a sense, there's no answer to that. Bigger, who's going to judge? Like, what, how are you going to figure that out? I mean, I really, like, at one point I fantasized about some kind of organization, like publishing, figuring out, doing the calculations and publishing, like, all right, if everybody on Earth like lived the same amount of resources, this is what their life would look like. So then you could like, okay, I'm going to live like that. So then I know I'm only taking my fair share and I'm good, and I can just stop right with all this stuff and I'm good. But it's like, there's no end to that.
I just wanted to add one thing, because I don't think I made my point very clear, and it's this. I think all I've read about and studied about in Buddhism has taught me this, and I know you have said this to me. I know you have taught me this, but it's think about it, but just don't get caught up in it. It's there, but don't get absorbed by it to the point where you can't practice at all. That's
all. And I also think about, the stories of indigenous peoples who will, when they are taking resources, when they're taking the life of a tree or a animal, they do it, but they do it consciously, and they do it with gratitude, and like so there is this acknowledgement of doing harm, but so in some senses I feel like it just reminds me of this is kind of a digression, but I'll get back to it. I used to when I lived at the Zen Center full time as a junior monk, and then there would be, I really liked the discipline of it, and the sitting and study at 24/7, and then in the summertime it would kind of get lighter and the lay people would go off on vacations and whatever, and I felt kind of at loose ends, like the structure was taken away, and I felt, yeah, and I was complaining about this to one of my late Dharma sisters, elder Dharma sister, and she was like, well, why don't you take a break? And I'm like, but like, and I just realized I kind of felt I felt kind of guilty about doing that, and like she's like, well, just don't feel guilty. And And I think, I think in some ways, like the, when we feel guilty, that's a, it's kind of a sign of, you know, something needs, we need to pay attention to something, but not usually what we think, right? The guilty is, we think, oh, I better stop that. But then we just kind of continue doing it and just feel guilty. It's almost like a weird cop-out mechanism. Like we can continue doing it as long as we feel guilty. Mm-hmm. Where sometimes if we're just like, I'm going to let go of that, and then it's just you eating your Italian sausage. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we can, I think I tend to be more open to the karmic consequences and the responsibility of that. And I don't know, because I think I kind of imagine, wouldn't it be cool if all of us, because just about any of us, right, somebody could look at your life and they could be like, you shouldn't be doing this, and you shouldn't be eating that, and you shouldn't be doing that. And then we'd be like this. We'd be kind of like, but you know, and we'd want to defend and get into an argument about why it is that we do what we do, and it's okay, and I've made my compromises and all that. And what if somewhere we're just like, yeah, I know. It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. Maybe I should make changes, you know? Go ahead, Courtney.
Well, I just had it. I'm sitting here thinking, this.
Oh. Go ahead, Ruth Hannah. Courtney's going right now, but I'll have you go next. Oh.
Okay. So I'm mulling over the combination of things that have come at me. And I feel like without dukkha, we wouldn't have Buddhism. Without these moral questions that the life brings up, we have no practice. And also, I feel for the questioner, the person who asked this question, I get it. But I also think that we're making an assumption that life was not hard then,
yes.
That there weren't moral questions then. They may have been different moral questions. Life was hard in a different way, maybe. But it's beginningless. It's and without these things, we aren't going to be sitting here in a room talking about them.
Good summary. Ruth Ann.
I appreciate your ending the July Dharma talk with sharing that practice isn't going to bring us solace necessarily, but solace is just one moment, one occasion on the human range. Pema Chodron's welcoming the unwelcome, she says, like, just sit, doesn't matter who is sitting, just sit. And there I go, but if there's mud, I look for the lotus, and why not? So, for this.
Thank you. Ethan.
So what comes to mind for me, and this is just kind of based off of where I am in my practice and also just kind of my understanding of Buddhism, is that basically the reason that we have dukkha, the reason that we suffer, we find life to be really unsatisfactory, is ultimately because the way that we interact with the world, the way that we involve ourselves with it, the way that we identify with it, is based off of ignorance and delusion. We're not seeing the way things they truly are. We're seeing the way we take things to be. And that the sort of perfected morality that's kind of espoused in Buddhism is not a result of the effort of an individual to make themselves perfect, but rather the result of practice itself,
yes,
dissolving the barriers we have in place that keep us tethered to our ignorant way of interacting with the world that keeps us tethered to greed, hatred, and delusion. And so for me, it's not a matter of, oh, I have to be moral in order to be a Buddhist and in order to practice. Rather, it's more like practice itself will result in a true and clear understanding of the way things actually are and will result in good, perfected morality at the very end. And so for me, it's more like we can't be perfect now because we're operating out of delusion. It's simply the way things are. And that it's not a matter of being the perfect. It's just a matter of being the best that we can be, doing things with the right intention. And ultimately, I think that's the whole purpose of the precepts, is to provide a sort of very basic moral framework or ground or foundation with which we can practice from. And that that sort of perfected morality comes at the end, and it's not something we need to be striving for right now. But thank you.
Yeah, I think the many, many karmic connections that we have in this world, even if we refrain from action, that is action, you know? Even if we're not doing something, that in a way might be allowing something to continue. And my Dharma uncle James Ford, who I just got to spend this last part of a week with, and we're going to be studying his book on Tuesdays. We have one of his previous books is, if you're lucky, your heart will break. Mm-hmm. And there's this, we can get to this sense of expansiveness, where we don't need to shrink from the grief and the ambiguity. I mean, we can only take so much of it at a time. We still have to take care of ourselves and be compassionate for ourselves. But that in a way, like, we're not, when our sense of self has become more permeable, we recognize it's not, I don't have to hold it, right? I can be open to it, but I don't have to fix it. I don't have to answer for it. I don't have to know what the answer is, but I can allow it without being destroyed, which is a very, you know, that's worth practicing for. It's that sense. All right. Well, at 12:15. Offer the merit of this, usually say Sangha meeting on Sundays? Abiding in this ephemeral world, like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Parami.